Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And this hour of the program, James Bamford is our guest. James is the author of a number of books that look at the NSA. The most recent is The Shadow Factory, the ultra-secret NSA from 9/11 to the eavesdropping on America. He says in the intro to his book that by this year, 2008, the NSA had become the largest, most costly, and most technologically sophisticated spy organization that the world has ever known. It has also become the most intrusive, secretly filtering millions of phone calls and emails an hour, international and domestic, through equipment that is programmed to watch and listen for hundreds of thousands of names and phone numbers. To sift through it all, the agency has the world's largest collection of data-eating supercomputers. And he talks about the latest one. He talks about the storage facility that has had to be built at huge cost and very, very large to cover all of this data. And the book also looks at the whole operation that existed in the United States and why we missed the fact that the hijacking operation and the flight training was taking place here in this country, what happened to our ability to eavesdrop on these people before 9/11 happened. And it looks at what has become, as we found out about in our interview about Vice President Cheney last week, a very, very big issue, illegal eavesdropping on Americans, and caused almost everybody in the Justice Department to resign some years ago. James, let me tell you more about him. He has written A Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and A Pretext for War. He's written on national security for the New York Times Magazine, for The Atlantic, for Harper's, Rolling Stone, and many other publications. He won the 2005 National Magazine Award for reporting for The Man Who Sold the War, and writes and produces television documentaries for the PBS series Nova. I understand that some of the subject matter in this book is going to be the subject of the latest program for NOAA. We're going to welcome phone calls. I'm sure we'll have many of them for James. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you would like to send an email, you can do that. And that is talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. Hi, James. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Kathleen.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you've been able to do this many books on the NSA when it must be so hard to do a book on the NSA, right? I mean, it's hard to get information.
Well, it's very hard. That's why there's been probably hundreds of books written on the CIA, and there's only been three written on NSA, and I wrote all three.
Mm-hmm. You start the book late December in Yemen's capital. Tell me what was going on in that capital. I found the part of the book fascinating to look at some of the 9/11 hijackers and the planners who were in various parts of the world. And we should have been doing perhaps a little bit more eavesdropping or acting on the eavesdropping we had done on some of these operations.
Well, that's right. Yemen was a very important place for Osama bin Laden and the terrorist operation. Osama bin Laden had trouble operating out of Afghanistan, so he set up a communications and logistics center in Yemen. He set it up actually in this house. It was a house outside the capital of Yemen, and the most of the communications that were going to and from bin Laden went through that house. But what happened in December of 1999 was that the NSA picked up a communications from that house. And the communication, it was a telephone call from bin Laden's people, and it was ordering two of the people associated with the house to go to Kuala Lumpur. And from there, they ended up going to the United States to start the terrorist operation. So NSA had been listening to this house, eavesdropping on it, for several years.
Wow.
And in December of 1999, it picked up its very first clue that this terrorist operation was going to take place.
Mm-hmm. And so they listen to that information, and then what do they do with it? Do they forward it to, if it's going to be what they think, a domestic problem, to the FBI or to the CIA, or is there such animosity and jealousy among these agencies, they hold on to it?
Well, that was the problem. They listened to the conversation, they recorded it, And then they really failed to give any of these conversations to the proper people, the FBI, the CIA. And when the terrorists came to the United States, they were actually living here for close to 2 years. NSA was eavesdropping on their phone calls from the United States back to the house in Yemen, bin Laden's operations center in Yemen. And yet NSA never told anybody that they were in the United States. And it got so bad that the terrorists actually moved into the same town NSA was living in. So the last month, the terrorists and the NSA were almost across the street from each other.
Oh, my gosh.
The NSA was at the at its headquarters right outside of Laurel and on the other side of the highway. The terrorists were living in a motel in Laurel, and that's where they were having their summit meetings. Mohammed Atta would fly up there. So you had this odd situation, a tragic situation of the terrorists and the NSA people living side by side. They were shopping in the same stores. They were exercising at Gold's Gym, the same gym. They were the terrorists were actually sending money back to the Middle East at the Safeway while NSA employees were shopping there one Saturday. So it's probably the biggest irony of the 9/11 tragedy. The biggest intelligence agency, the most expensive intelligence agency in the country, was listening to these people. They were across the street from them right up until the day of the attack, and never either sought out where they were or told anybody where they were.
Mm-hmm. And as two of them who had been in California for quite some time made their way across the country, they were even arrested, weren't they, in Oklahoma or someplace?
That's right, yeah. They were stopped in Oklahoma for speeding and given a ticket, and nothing happened. I mean, one of the things that is really amazing is these people were living very openly. They were not living covertly. In their house in San Diego, they listed their name, their full name, in the telephone directory, as well as their telephone number and their address. Bought a car in San Diego in their real name. Their registration was in their real name. And when they checked into the motels, were in the same town that NSA was, they were living there under their real name. So although NSA was looking for Khalid al-Mihdhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, they were registered under their real names in the motel in the same town.
Why do you think they used their real names?
Well, they really had to some degree, because some of the places they went, they had to show proof of who they were, and they didn't have any phony IDs at the time, so they used their real name. So they got their driver's license under the real name. So from then on, they just continually used their real name. Plus, I'm sure they didn't have any idea that the U.S. had their names, were actually looking for them. And in reality, NSA had their names for several years at that point.
So you almost hate to go there, but we do need to go there. If NSA had taken this information and given it to, who do they need to give it to avert, do you think, or possibly avert, give us a good chance of averting the tragedy of September 11th?
Well, they from the very beginning, they could have turned that information over to the FBI or the State Department when they first picked up their names, and it could have been stopped early on, because they were listening to their conversations in San Diego, and they were communicating to the operations center in Yemen, so they could have easily gotten a warrant from this court known as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and told the FBI, and the FBI could have been eavesdropping on their calls. They could have heard their calls with Mohammed Atta. They could have gotten the whole idea of what the plot was and who was involved by listening to them, and I think that could have been stopped. But the problem was nobody knew where they were, even though NSA was listening to them in the U.S., and it just boggles the mind that, I can look at my phone and see where your phone call's coming from, and you've got a $8 billion agency over there, and right. that... they either weren't looking to see where the phone calls were coming from, or else they were looking and not telling anybody where they were coming from.
Mm-hmm. I believe I read somewhere that you are doing a documentary on this part of your book, and that you went to that house in Yemen. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We did shooting lots of different parts of the world. We basically followed the trail of the two hijackers, the two original hijackers, Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi. They were the ones who were the first ones to come to the United States. They arrived in January of 2000, and they were here for close to 2 years. So but the whole thing began in Yemen, at this house in Yemen, where NSA first picked up the phone call, and it's where the terrorists were basically sent from. It was where they were, at least where Khalid al-Midar was living at the time. So, we traced them from there to Kuala Lumpur, and then Kuala Lumpur to San Diego, and then across the country to New Jersey, and then up to Laurel, Maryland, where NSA was. So, it's a fascinating look at these two terrorists who came into the United States, were communicating to and from the United States, and also at the same time at the agency that was listening to them and trying to find them, and then why the terrorist attack wasn't prevented.
Yeah. What kind of information, what kind of chatter were people in the administration and who in the administration was hearing a lot of chatter in the summer before September 11?
Well, the NSA was picking it up. The problem was it wasn't giving it to anybody. It wasn't giving it to the CIA, for example. And I interviewed for the documentary, and that's going to be airing on January 13th, the former head of the Bin Laden unit at CIA. That was the person in charge of the organization in CIA trying to find Bin Laden. And he kept trying to get NSA to give him transcripts from that house. And all they would do was give him brief summaries every few weeks. And so he got very angry, basically, and the CIA, because they couldn't get this information from NSA, ended up going and building their own intercept facility, trying to duplicate NSA's efforts in the Indian Ocean area to collect the satellite telephone calls. And they did that. They actually built it, and they were eavesdropping on the house, but because their technology wasn't as good as NSA's, they were only picking up one side of the conversations and not the other side. So they went to the NSA and said, we're now able to get half the conversations, but can you give us the other half? Oh. They still wouldn't give them the other half.
Oh, my goodness.
So this, this is what happened right up until 9/11, that the NSA's eavesdropping on these people and refusing to give the information to anybody. The whole thing was absurd, and especially when you think that here they were, of all places, living basically across the Baltimore Washington Parkway from them.
Yeah, that's just you can't help but conjure that image as you're reading the book. It was just unbelievable, and I'm sure that this building their own system was highly expensive, wasn't it?
Sure, it was. They had I'm not exactly sure where they built it. They built it in the Indian Ocean area. I think it might have been Madagascar.
Hmm.
But it would have involved building a whole satellite facility, mm-hmm, to catch the satellite signals and then forwarding the information back and all that. So, sure, it was expensive. Mm-hmm. The taxpayers are paying for it when you've already got an $8 billion agency that's already collecting it, which, it doesn't make much sense.
No. So how is it all being gathered now, all of the information, the eavesdropping? How's it taking place now?
Well, there was a switch, largely in the late 1990s. Communications switched from satellites to undersea cables because undersea cables became fiber optic. They were they switched into a far more efficient way of transmitting communications. That was a big problem for NSA, because when you're collecting the signals from a satellite, all you're doing is putting a big dish out there, and waiting for the signals to fall into them. And the dish can be almost anywhere in a large geographical area. And the best part about it is you don't have to have any cooperation from anybody in the telecom companies. But when the companies began shifting to all these undersea cables in the late 90s and throughout the 2000s, NSA had a major problem. They weren't able to collect a lot of these signals anymore. So what they did was after 9/11, they began making secret agreements with the telecom companies, such as AT&T.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would, because the only way they could get access to the information was physically by tapping it. They began building these secret rooms in the company's major switches.
Which is something that the American people were upset about, I know, but I'm wondering what's happening with that right now. What is that legal, what they've done? Are there? I know there have been challenges to this. Where does all of that stand right now, James?
Well, it's just very confusing right now. It was pretty simple before the warrantless eavesdropping came along. There was a law that said if you eavesdrop on an American, you need to get a warrant from this court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And that was followed very religiously before 9/11. And then after 9/11, Bush and Cheney and the head of NSA launched this warrantless eavesdropping program where they bypassed the court. And that's what caused when some of this was discovered by the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General and the head of the FBI, they threatened to resign. And they made some changes in the program. And then eventually the Congress passed a bill last summer that reworked that law. It's a very complex law, and it's hard to tell what's legal and what isn't legal now. But one of the other things they did was they gave immunity to the telecom companies for any potential illegality they were involved in while they were working on this warrantless wiretapping program.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where it stands right now. It's a very confusing mess because Congress really, I don't think, paid much attention to the way the bill was written. They fought the bill for a number of months from February until July, and then facing an election and worried about charges of being weak on terrorism or whatever, they decided to cave in and they agreed to the bill and so it was passed. So now it's basically taken a lot of the power away from that court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is worrisome because that court is the only buffer between this huge agency with its enormous ability to eavesdrop on everybody and the American public.
Yeah. We're taking phone calls for James, and we'll take them in a moment. James Bamford is our guest this hour. His latest book is The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. He has written extensively about the National Security Agency, the only person actually to have detailed in several books the workings of this agency. The book looks at it on a number of issues, the kind of warrantless eavesdropping that has been going on. Some of it, perhaps you've heard some other interviews with James, people who are hired to eavesdrop on fairly intimate conversations people in Iraq were having with people at home. And part of the book that I found fascinating is he follows several of the 9/11 hijackers as people knew they were here in the United States. They were plotting. They were traveling. They had their names. And they were even living right across the street from the NSA in the days before the horrendous events of 9/11, which is hard to believe, huh? All right, to your phone calls. Did I give you the number 800-486-8655? If you would like to send an email, that's talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Let's start with an email, James. The main question, this is from Gene, why has there not been some accountability?
Well, I think the main reason that there hasn't been any real accountability by NSA is because the agency exists in this really secret world, and few people have wanted to penetrate it. There's been a number of people that called for hearings on NSA, but nobody in Congress was willing to have those hearings. Those are hearings that leading up to the bill that was passed last summer. But now with the revelations in the Shadow Factory, in my book, that NSA was actually eavesdropping not just on Al-Qaeda or terrorists, mm-hmm. it was eavesdropping on Americans, both the Senate Intelligence Committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee have said that they're looking into holding hearings and have called for investigation. So maybe there will be some accountability.
Mm-hmm. And I've seen you being interviewed with at least one of the whistleblowers who was eavesdropping on conversations of humanitarian workers and soldiers in Iraq to their loved ones at home. What a colossal waste of money and their time, because they were, and in a way, it's just this voyeurism, because they were listening to conversations that were fairly intimate and had to do with how much spouses missed each other. And it's you wonder why they went that direction.
Well, that's one of the reasons they became whistleblowers, was because they thought it was wrong. They didn't join the military and become part of NSA to do that. They did it to find terrorists. One of the people that became a whistleblower joined right after 9/11, and both these people were very educated. They both have master's degrees and so forth. So, they were trying to do the right thing, and they didn't like what they saw. They didn't like what was going on, and they complained to their bosses. One of the whistleblowers, after she got out, she actually even put all this information in a letter and sent it to Senator Leahy, who was on the Judiciary Committee and the Intelligence Committee, and never heard another word. That was a year and a half ago. So that's how whistleblowers become whistleblowers, mm-hmm. because they get so frustrated in trying to change the system, correct what's going wrong, by going through the right channel. So finally, after she finally went public, then within a day or so, she started hearing back from Senator Leahy. So it's tragic that it has to come to that, but that was the only way to get action.
Mm-hmm. Stephen from Middleton is joining us. Hi, Stephen.
Mr. Benford, you seem to have very good sources within the shadow government. I would like to know, how come it's so difficult to connect the dots with all these clues that 9/11 was an inside job? Who planted the explosives that pulverized the skyscrapers in 10 seconds?
Well, my view on that is, it's pretty standard view. It's the terrorists came here, they plotted the attack, and they attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. I don't believe there was any involvement of the U.S. government or any conspiracy involving the government to do this.
Let's talk about how difficult it is to get a book like this out. You have interviews with whistleblowers. If this is such a secret world that few people have been able to penetrate it, how can you penetrate it? How did you penetrate it?
Well, first of all, I've been doing it for a very long time. My mm-hmm. first book on NSA came out in 1982. The Puzzle Palace, and then I did a sequel to The Puzzle Palace that came out in May of 2001 called Body of Secrets, and so I've been, and then in addition to The Shadow Factory, this book here, so I've been writing on it for a very long time. In addition, I've been writing articles on it when I wasn't writing books on it, so I've been looking into NSA for a very long time, and I've developed a lot of sources. When my first book came out, The Puzzle Palace, the NSA threatened me twice with
what? Did we lose you? Oh, my gosh. It was not a time to lose him. We'll have to find our guest again. The phone line just eerily left us. We're talking this hour. John will try and reach him again with the author of The Shadow Factory. James Bamford is our guest. He is, and the subtitle is The Ultra Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping of America. He has, you just heard him say, has been at this for a long period of time. Best-selling author of Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and A Pretext for War. He's written on national security for the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, Harper's, Rolling Stone, and many other publications. And his Rolling Stone article, The Man Who Sold the War, won the 2005 National Magazine Award for reporting. We're welcoming phone calls for James at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and you can send us an email. He's back at talk@WPR.org.
Yeah, I think there was an intervening there briefly. They do that occasionally.
I never think that, but what a time for you to just sort of disappear, wasn't it? Oh, my. So you were talking about how people then have come to you. You've been at this for a long period of time, and how you penetrated this.
They threatened me with prosecution for my first two books, and then, I mean, for my first book on NSA called The Puzzle Palace. And then when Body Secrets came out in 2001, the sequel, they actually had a book signing for me at NSA. So
I read that.
It's sort of this love-hate relationship with NSA, and they've given me tours through the agency. I've interviewed a lot of officials, not just whistleblowers, but officials and so forth. So I've been doing this a long time, and I've developed a lot of contacts along the way. I mean, that's basically how I've been doing this.
Mm-hmm. And you write about the amount of information they have. How is this stored? And you also write that they've had to build this whole new, you wonder who in the world they're listening to, because they've had to build a whole new multi-million-dollar facility to store all the information they've collected.
Well, that was one of the other things that really surprised me. The NSA has a huge facility. It's basically got an entire city right outside of Laurel, Maryland, where its headquarters is. It consists of over 50 buildings. And yet with all that, they were running out of space and running out of power to store all this data that they were recording, because they weren't erasing much. They were just keeping it all. And so they had to build a brand-new facility in Texas, this huge data warehouse outside of San Antonio. And it's almost the size of the Alamo Dome. And when you figure how much data you could just put on a little flash drive or thumb drive, 2 gigabytes or whatever, you can imagine how much data you could put in a warehouse that size. And the other worrying thing about it is that it's not just for storage. It appears that it's for data mining. They're going to assign about 1,400 people down there.
Why don't they erase anything?
Well, you know, before this whole issue of warrantless eavesdropping, that was the rule. It was called minimization. And if you picked up an American, you erase it. That was the law. That was what the regulations were. After warrantless eavesdropping came into existence, according to the people I was talking to, they said that they were told not to erase anything, they would get into trouble if they started erasing things. So so the calls would come in. They're recorded. They transcribe them, and then the recordings would go to NSA, and they'd be kept forever. I mean, nobody's going to go through and erase these afterwards. The time to erase them is when they come in and you realize these are Americans talking. So that's another thing that I really think that should be looked into, is this whole issue of not only who's being eavesdropped on, but what's being done once all this information is being collected.
Right,
and it's not just telephone calls. It's the email. It's what web pages you're going to. NSA has the capability now to eavesdrop on virtually all forms of communication. So that's why it's far more dangerous today than it was when I began writing about it in 1982.
Scott is next from La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. Thank you again for a wonderful program. What I'd like to ask is, with this data mining going on such a massive scale as you've just outlined, with all these various media being monitored, and I'm nobody's idea of a terrorist, but I know I get stuff in email all the time that's, you know, some kind of a joke somebody's got where they mention Al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden, you know, with some hysterical cartoon or punchline. And if that is red flagging for all of the, and I'm assuming what they have are computers that are monitoring for certain data strings that they would then alert somebody. But at some point, human judgment has to come in, I would think, and they would have to say, let's check this one, or let's check that one, or let's follow up on this, and that kind of thing. And if you're dealing on this massive of a scale, never mind the legality, where is the efficacy in making us safer with this much to go through, never mind save and store and look back on and try and find more information? I mean, you'd think at some point they'd have to hire the entire population of the United States just to monitor all of our communications.
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, those issues are the issues that really need to be looked into. And those are the issues I get into in the Shadow Factory. It's a problem of being flooded with too much information. And as you mentioned, you know, they may program these computers to look for certain words or certain strings and so forth. But the terrorists themselves aren't using those words or those strings. They're calling up and they're saying, you know, remember the wedding's a week from tomorrow. Do you have all the, are all the grooms ready for it or something like that? I mean, they could be using these word codes that have nothing to do with terrorism. So that's NSA's problem. It's NSA's problem with terrorism. Is that it was never designed to look for terrorists. It was designed to watch for attacks by the Soviet Union, nuclear attacks. That's why NSA completely missed the first World Trade Center bombing in 93. It missed the attack on the USS Cole. It missed the attacks on the U.S. embassies in East Africa, and it missed 9/11. So it's got a track record of not being able to do very good on terrorism, and one of the reasons is just as you mentioned there, it's too much information coming from too many sources with not enough people to analyze it. Mm-hmm. It was much different when it was the Soviet Union because they were just listening to one country and they knew the frequencies and they knew the which communications to eavesdrop on, you know, the military communications, diplomatic communications. They were all on certain dedicated channels, and they would just listen to those communications. Some of them were encrypted, and they couldn't break them, but they got a lot of intelligence by listening to what they could. With terrorists, there is no dedicated channel. There is no terrorist channel like there is for the Soviet military. They use communications anywhere in the world. Today they might be in Kenya. The next day they might be in India or someplace. So that's NSA's problem, and that's why this agency has sort of scrambled to try to make up for its deficits by trying to pull in too much information. It hasn't been able to find the terrorists in the information it picks up, so it starts picking up too much information, and then it gets flooded, and that was one of the complaints that the whistleblowers were having, was that they were spending too much time on information that was totally useless. So that's the dilemma. Where does NSA draw the line on what is useful and what isn't? How much information should they pull in, and how much shouldn't they? Just one other problem there was languages. The whistleblowers I spoke to said that they were at the main listening post for the Middle East. And they said they had nobody there that spoke Pashtun, which is the principal language of the Taliban. Now, this is at a time that we went to war with Afghanistan. So you not only have a flood of information, you don't have the right people speaking the right languages.
And it seems to me as though you need thousands and thousands of people to listen to all this information. If you have that much information, who are they hiring to do this job, which must be pretty time-consuming, unless they're just looking for certain – well, even then it's time-consuming – certain words in a conversation, or do they listen to a whole big chunk of a conversation? How can anybody accomplish this task?
Well, that's the big problem. They do have thousands. The NSA's listening post for the Middle East, I think people would be rather surprised to find out it's located in the state of Georgia near the South Carolina border. That's where they listen to the Middle East from. And they're building and expanding the facility, and when it's finished, it'll have about 4,000 people there. Hmm. That's just one listening post. Hmm. But when it comes to telephone calls, they just do it the old-fashioned way. They sit there with earphones on, and they have these antennas, satellites, and big dishes that pull everything in, and then they just listen to it. It's much more efficient with data communications like email, because then you can program computers to pick out certain words and so forth. Again, there you get into the huge amounts of information coming in, and how do you know which information is going to be valuable and which information is not?
Right. Thanks, Scott, for the call. Let's go to Robert from Eau Claire. Hi, Robert.
Hello. Yeah, it was my understanding, and I picked this up just before 9/11, that the British and the United States were working together to create this Dana Mining Mole, Cornelius, or whatever one it was. And then, of course, there was a gag order put on it. It went before the United Nations. Of course, the United Nations voted it down because they knew they would be spying on their economic and intellectual assets. And then after that, the New York Attorney General, after September 11th, maybe 2 years later, there was a whistleblower that realized that a lot of data was being collected from universities all over the United States, in particular off the West Coast, where most of our Nobel Prize winners come from. And they were collecting that data into New York and then siphoning it out to the Laurel, Maryland area, and, of course, the U.S. Navy, which helps the NSA do its work. And I guess my question would be, considering the NSA is generally run by foreign entities, the Negroponte class of people that comes out of London, how much of our efforts to do research and development at universities is being squandered and given away to other countries so that they can beat us to the punch on patenting our intellectual assets? I don't believe the NSA is concerned in the least, but especially with your last caller and your comments, in the least bit about anything that has anything to do with national security, or they would have been able to cross the road and figure out, like the chicken, would have been able to cross the road and get there before the egg and make things happen. So this is really about economics like everything else and really about stealing from the American public again, and this is a private organization, not a public organization. I'll have to take your answer on the phone. I'm at the courthouse.
Okay. Thanks, Robert.
Well, there was a lot of things there. I mean, it's not a private organization. Everybody pays for it. It's a government agency. There are a couple points there that are interesting. NSA does have extremely close relationships with other intelligence agencies, especially the British equivalent of NSA. It's an agency called the GCHQ, which does the same thing as NSA. And ironically, the relationship between NSA and the British GCHQ is closer, far closer than it is with the CIA or any other intelligence agency. And that was one of the complaints that the CIA official I interviewed said was that, NSA was sharing everything with their British partner, but they weren't giving anything to the CIA. So, I mean, that was ironic that the agency is more closely associated with and gives more information to its foreign partner than it does to its domestic partner. And in terms of the data mining, NSA does pick up tremendous amounts of information. And one of the things that just came out recently, it just came out a couple weeks ago, was a study by, I think it was the Congressional Research Service, that looked into the whole issue of data mining, and they basically concluded that there's not much there. I mean, they pick all this stuff up, and they don't really come up with much. On paper, it sounds like a good idea. You pick all this stuff up, and, you know, receipts, who goes through what toll booth, who buys what books, who goes to what cities or whatever, and you put all that together, and you come up with who the terrorists are and what the Congressional Research Service said is basically all black magic. It doesn't really happen.
Have they come up with, though, from all of your reporting on this, some very crucial, important information, James?
Well, I'm sure it probably does come up with important information occasionally. I don't have access to all what NSA's successes are. I would hope it would have a few successes here or there.
Right.
But and everybody I've talked to, there's never been any real huge successes. And there have been huge failures, but not any huge successes that they can point to, either publicly or on background information. So, NSA is an important agency. I don't want to say it should be thrown away or anything, but it's really got to be looked at. And the way it's been handled during the Bush administration is it's been abused, basically. It's an agency that has potential, but by doing all this domestic eavesdropping and taking away the rules, it's made the agency less safe rather than more safe. You know, I mean, the comparison is with the deregulate all the financial institutions and you have the mess we have now. Well, this is what happens when you deregulate the eavesdropping. Mm-hmm. You take all the rules and regulations out and the buffers between the U.S. and U.S. citizens and the agencies, and what you've got is people listening to intimate conversations and passing them out like at a bar room.
James Bamford is our guest. His latest book, The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. Thanks very much for your call, Robert. We have one line open, 800-486-8655 is the number. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to your phone calls now for James Bamford, author of The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. Let's go next to David from De Pere. Hi, David.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Just fine. Say, I'm employ a small business, and I had a young man work for me for about most of 10 years, was a math prodigy, and wound up at the NSA. And I had to meet both with the FBI and private investigators to vet this man's qualifications and character before he went to work for NSA. He's been there about 2 years. And when he came back to see me this fall for a visit, he was telling me how toxic the environment is within the agency, that there's career employees of the agency who've dedicated their life to protecting this country, as he put it, who felt their work has been compromised by dictates from the current administration that only wants intelligence that conforms to their politics, I guess is the simplest way I can say it. And they basically, if they know someone from the administration's coming in to visit, there's essentially a lockdown that goes on because they're trying to, they feel, preserve their integrity, which has been under severe attack during the previous few years. That was interesting to get that feedback from a new employee who hasn't been there long enough yet to actually get the heat. And one last comment for all the, Kathleen, talking about all the people listening to headphones of these conversations, the Simpsons did a spoof on that, showing a vast room with thousands of people hunched over their computer monitors wearing earphones, and one out-of-context comment from Marge Simpson caused a man to leap up in ecstasy. For years I've been listening, we got one. We finally got one in this room with thousands of people cheering.
James.
Yeah, well, that's a good, interesting comment because my previous book was A Pretext for War, in which I wrote all about how the Bush administration largely manipulated the intelligence and used fear-mongering and so forth to get the war in Iraq. You know, that's the problem with this administration, and I've written about NSA since 1982, and until this administration came in, I never heard of anybody really trying to pressure intelligence people or the people, you know, with the earphones on and officials at NSA to get the intelligence they to the way they wanted it, and that's what happened here. I interviewed the director of NSA, and He says that the information they presented, he felt was ambiguous, the information that was played at the United Nations from NSA. Yet the administration made it look like it was completely definitive. And so it's sad to hear that happening at NSA, but I guess it's throughout the intelligence community that this whole problem of slanting the intelligence to go along with the policy decisions, has been intelligence community-wide.
And who did you say, David, came to vet the guy who worked for you, somebody from the FBI?
Correct. I had to deal with an FBI agent who came in from Chicago, and then I had to meet with a private investigator who was hired by NSA. My young man started for me at age 14, and he was flown 3 times out to Maryland for interviews after they recruited him from UW Oshkosh. He was a math prodigy. And,
right.
And he understood computers the way, I can't make a good comparison. But he was, a prodigy is the best word to describe him.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's interesting because I've discovered that NSA is now outsourcing their, they're outsourcing so much. They outsource the eavesdropping, outsource almost everything, and they're outsourcing their security, too. They have private investigators now. I know they hire private investigators to do these background investigations rather than have government employees do it. So and math prodigies and people that are extremely good at math are among the prime people NSA is trying to recruit because they're always trying to build a better way to eavesdrop or a better way to break codes and so forth.
Thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Milton next from Cedarburg. Hi, Milton.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bamford, for writing your book. We've actually known about a lot of the NSA shenanigans for years and years, but it just seems like only when a well-known author comes along and writes a book about it do we ever really get to publicly discuss it. And we did really know a lot of this stuff, at least the NSA watchers, the Intel watchers, before your book came out, but I'm sure glad you wrote it. Do you know anything about the Artificial Intelligence Project going in New Mexico? And what kind of retaliation have you received from NSA? I once went to court with them in the 90s, and I can tell you they are not real nice people, and I would hope someday that the story of a certain Madison journalist would be told who was leaned on very heavily would get covered.
Well, thanks for the call. With regard to the pressure, I haven't gotten any pressure from NSA yet, but the book just came out last week, so I don't know whether they're finding any pressure or not. But this is the third book I've written on NSA, so I've sort of been doing this for a long time now, and I just write it whether NSA likes it or not. With regard to the artificial intelligence project, I'm not sure which one is in New Mexico, but one of the ones I write about in the Shadow Factory is this one called ACQUAINT, which is it's an acronym. I think it's called Answer Questions Intelligence, and what it's designed to do is to go beyond what most people know in terms of trying to find information. And they've actually got it where they feed huge amounts of information to a computer, and then they could ask actually intelligent questions of the computer, like what's Jim Bamford's next book going to be or something like that. And they're working on it. I don't think they've finished it yet, but it's one of the more advanced projects they have in terms of artificial intelligence.
What is your next book going to be?
Well, I'm going to have to ask the NSA because they probably know. I usually ask them. They know before I do, usually.
Yeah, they tell you what direction to go to. Thanks very much for your call. I'm tempted to take another call, but I better not. We only have 30 seconds left. So, James, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate the hour, and you go where people don't go. So thank you.
Well, Thank you, Kathleen. And they were really good questions from both you and the audience. So it was good being on your program.
Thanks, James. James Bamford. The book is The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. James is also the author of Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and A Pretext for War. Has written on national security for the New York Times Magazine, for Atlantic, Harper's, Rolling Stone, and many other publications. The book just came out last week. And I'm sure you can find it in your local bookstore. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Just a reminder that I always have to get the sheet behind me, that we're going to be at Marquette on Thursday. It's a special broadcast. We'll broadcast live as we count down the days until the presidential election. And we'll have students with us who are involved in campaigns. Political analysts will join us. Journalists covering the national campaigns will be with us. And you're invited. Should be kind of fun. Political talk from everybody with a reception to follow. If you want to come, the admission is free, but just let us know. You'll be in the audience. 414-227-2047, the number to call. Thanks for listening. Until tomorrow.